I'm Tony Craig. I play Jacques on Due South.
I am Catherine Bruyer.
Hey, everyone. This is Ramona Milano, otherwise known as Francesca Vecchio.
This is Paul Haggis, and you're listening to Due South by Southeast.
I wish this podcast would carry me away. But while talking to Squeaky and Michelle get a word in edgeways, recouped over a bottle of rum on the dock of Southampton Bay. Due South, that is what we're talking about. Due South. Saddle up my microphone, give the Finn Baker a bone.
Hello and welcome to a very special sort of mashup event, if you will. So anyone who usually tunes into my other podcast, the Dr. Squeeze Show, I'm away this weekend for the bank holiday here in the UK. I'll be away LARPing, live action role play, but that's not important right now. So instead, what I've done is a sort of mashup between my interview show and my other show, Due South by Southeast. So I am, for the purposes of this, Detective Squee. With me usually would be Monty Michelle, but she gets shy when I interview people, and that's what we're doing tonight. So we give love and shout out to Michelle, who is probably off somewhere doing something wonderful as an NHS nurse, so we always give her praise and love for that. But tonight we've got a special episode of Due South by Southeast. Every now and again, as you will have heard in the intro to this show, we have some Due South, as well as Canadian acting legends on this show, and tonight is no exception. He's already a friend of the show. He always watches the streams and comments very generously. He's so generous and free with his time to the fans, as well as being in Due South. He has been in such shows as Degrassi, Robocop, Heroes. He's worked on projects starring Harvey Keitel, Tia Carrera, and Adam Garcia in a career spanning 40 years and five decades. But most of you will be tuning in to hear about his work as Detective Thomas Dewey, or Hayseed Number One, as he's also known, on Due South. Please give a big Dr. Squeeze Show and Due South by Southeast welcome to the one, the only, Tom Melissus. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, my. Wow. After that intro, I'm pretty pumped up. Thank you for that. That was awesome. You're amazing. I love your energy.
Oh, you got to go in big. You can't just like, you know, half-ass these things, especially when someone's been kind enough to give up their time. How is Canada today?
Actually, you know, we've had a pretty hot and humid summer up until the last few weeks. It's been very volatile. We've been getting cold fronts and warm and then like heavy thunderstorms. Some parts of the city were flooded, but where I live, we're okay. So today is a very cool day, the way I love it, which is sunny, but not too hot, not too cold. So it's lovely.
Sounds absolutely delicious there today. Yeah, we've been having the heat here in the UK, which is very unusual, which you've just come back from, which we will get onto in a minute. But I did want to do just two things up front, if you don't mind. First of all, because I know I'll forget, if you wouldn't mind doing a little bumper for the front of the podcast, just like... my name's Tom Melissus, aka, just intro the show a little bit for Due South by Southeast, please.
Do you call yourself Dr. Squee?
Dr. Squee, Detective Squee, just Squee.
Detective Squee, okay.
All right. However you like to roll, my friend.
All right, okay. I'll say something about the show. Hi, this is Tom Melissus, also known as Detective Thomas Dewey from Due South, and I am very honored to be a guest on Dr. Squee. He's awesome.
Excellent. Thank you so much, sir. Sorry, I almost cut you off there. And also, if you wouldn't mind, just because she isn't joining us today, and as I say, my friend Michelle is my co-host here, and she's also one of our wonderful NHS nurses here, which I always like to shout out because I'm very proud of her for that. So if you'd just like to say hi to her very quickly, that'd be lovely.
hey, Michelle, you know, every time I've seen Dr. Squee in action, I've seen you in the background, and now you're not there. It just seems empty.
And I will say, you say she's in the background. She's just very short. She's actually right up in front of the screen. It's no, just... I never miss the opportunity to give Mountie Michelle a good height joke in there.
Oh, my. Well, all right. Good luck when she sees you next in person.
Oh, we've been best friends for years. I'm not going to change now. So, yeah, your recent visit to the UK, I'm really sorry we couldn't meet up, but the stars just didn't align between everything which you were doing. How was your visit? How was meeting the Jews over here?
Oh, it was awesome. It was so much better than I thought it was. I'm not a big fan of flying, which was giving me all sorts of anxiety, but I put myself in a good frame of mind because the real thing was I was going to, with my wife and son, to visit her two aunts and her uncle. And when I travel, I'm not a big fan of sightseeing. I love connecting with the people. And I tell you, I was bowled over with the hospitality, the generosity of my wife's cousins. I mean, on the one side, her dad had two aunts, Joy and Lorna. Fantastic, generous people. Their children were amazing. One of them has eight kids. What's going on over there in England? What's in the water? Wow. It's insane. And then
usually much colder over here. So put that together however you will.
Okay, I got you. Home heating. And then her mother's side, the Newmans, in the small town of Thetford, which was so relaxed and so laid back. And her two aunts were in Whitstable, little seaside town. Yeah. I both towns were beautiful, and the people were so friendly. And that's what did it for me. You know, we went through London by bus, and that's where we met up with a Due South fan, Lynn Collinson. She had the beautiful graciousness of driving, I don't know, 2-3 hours to meet me at the Victoria Station, where we're waiting for a connecting bus. And she showed up with a bottle of sarsaparilla as a gift. And we sat down for 45 minutes. It was herself, my wife, my son, and my sister-in-law. And for 45 minutes, it was just condensed chaos. It was lovely. We sat down, we chatted. And then later on, when we went to Whitstable, Lauren and Dave and her Uncle Al North, they came to Whitstable, and we spent about 4.5 hours along the beach. We had lunch. We had Mr. Whippy, which is something new to me. It's ice cream.
Yep. Awesome. Yep.
But, you know, the weather was great. The hospitality was fantastic. And that's what made it for me when I travel, is connecting with people. And as I said, my wife's family were fantastic. Her relatives were awesome. And meeting up with Lynn and Dave and Lauren and Uncle Al, who they drove 3.5 hours to meet me. And I was just bowled over. And I mean, I wanted to come up your way, but I was on my wife's schedule. So what can I say? Here we are, though.
Yeah. And at the same time, I was popping between different events.
You were away, too. You had a little weekend getaway yourself, I recall.
Yeah, I had two back-to-back, as it happens. I was at an event called Fantasy Forest over here, which was just absolutely lovely. It's set on the castle grounds. And it was just absolute bonkers. And then next weekend, being a geek as I am, I was off at a Star Trek convention. So I was on my travels, too. I had like 2 days in between, so it was going to be tight for meeting up anyway. So
Yeah. Anyhow.
Like you say, we got there in the end.
Here we are. Good to see you, though.
And we are going to be reading out your questions. If you're watching live, please do pop the question in the chat. Happy to throw in a few live ones as well. So, yeah, let's take it right back for yourself, though. Tell us about the early days as an actor, how you got into acting. And what I found really interesting from the other interviews I've had is how vast candor is, but how small the acting scene seems to be for some actors' experiences. I was wondering.
That's pretty accurate. I mean, Canada is a big country, and it's not as heavily populated as some countries. So things are spread out. Now, in regards to how I started out as an actor, well, you know, I was probably not new to anyone. I was a very hyperactive child and, you know, a bit of a clown. I was shy at first, and then I discovered that if I put on characters and put on an act, I could get attention and favorable attention. So I was doing a lot of that growing up in my early years, grades 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then about halfway through high school, I discovered a more serious side to performing. I probably would say one of my most inspirational films was two films called, one was called Next Stop Greenwich Village, and the other was Dog Day Afternoon. And what I saw there was a really intense side to acting. that was a great outlet, not just comedy, but that was pretty intense. And I found out, oh, there are acting schools. And I thought I'd try it. And at first I was a little intimidated and I got discouraged, took a break, performed in a new wave punk band for a couple of years, and then went back to it.
Sorry, we're going to take a detour on the new wave punk band. Tell me a little bit about that. What was it called? We'll go back to the acting in a second. Come on, you can't throw that one out and expect me not to ask.
Have you heard of Spandau Ballet? No, I'm kidding. No, I've changed. No, yeah, there is a beautiful concert hall in Toronto called Massey Hall. It's over 100 years old and many performers perform there. And I worked there for 10 years as an usher. And I met up with a diverse amount of friends. And somehow one summer, after my first year of acting school, I was discouraged. I didn't want to act ever again. And some of the guys said, hey, we're getting together to jam. You want to just be our vocalist, be our front guy. And I can't sing. I hold two notes, but I had pretty good presence. So that time, you know, who was on the scene was, you know, Joe Strummer, the Pistols, all that raunchy stuff where really the vocals are deceivingly poor, but actually weren't bad. But I was horrible. So I that summer, I played in a band called The Exploding Tickets.
Brilliant.
Which it's, I think it was based on a book by William S. Burroughs, some to the effect of your ticket is no longer valid. Something about impotence. Anyway, that's another place. So that band was a good outlet for me for a few years. We had different transformations, people come and go. We went from called The Exploding Tickets to Return to Normal. And then finally it was the Groom Kirby 12. But the main through line of all our music was kind of more funk than punk. More funk than punk. So, and that was fun. And then I went back to acting after that. And was one summer I landed an agent, started working. And then I decided, hey, why am I continuing through acting school when I'm already working? Which in hindsight has its ups and downs. But that was 26 years old. And I started touring doing comedy. And then after that, a little bit of DB, I appeared on Degrassi Junior High.
Sorry, again, I'm just going to jump in there, the comedy bit. So, like, how did that go? Was that, like, straight-up stand-up? Was it sketches? Oh, what kind of thing was that?
Good. That's a good – you're very good. You're very good. You're good. You're very good. Anyway, well, the comedy part, I did in high school try stand-up comedy and open mic, which some of it went well, some of it didn't. And, you know, and then what I said when I did the comedy, it was a comedy troupe called The Second City. Here in North America, which for those of you who don't know, they did SCTV. They produce great comedians.
Rick Moranis, Joe Candy.
Mike Myers. I mean, I was Mike Myers' understudy. For those of you who don't remember Mike Myers, he was Austin Powers. And I was his understudy. And I worked with Colin Mochrie, who was also on a show called Whose Line Is It Anyway? Which I understand recorded in England. And it's pretty popular here. So that was, it was sketch comedy, improv comedy. And I had never taken a class, but I auditioned. And just so happens that the directors, who were all female, thought I looked like a young De Niro. So they said, we'll hire you, not because you're funny, but because you're good to look at. And yeah, not much has changed. I'm kidding.
Well, you're certainly damn fine look at, sir. But like, I'm sure kind of also like an amazing actor. So.
Well, thank you. But that was a fun experience because I toured the country and I had never been on a plane. And we went to the East Coast, known as the Maritimes. It's Nova Scotia, Newfoundland. Then we went through Northern Ontario. And then we went out west, Alberta, BC. So I got to see the country and on someone else's tab, which is an actor's dream. That's why we do it. Because, no, I shouldn't say that's why we. That's why I enjoy doing it. I've traveled a lot of places and mostly because of the work. So that I spent two years doing comedy, that type of comedy. And then they let me go because they wanted me to move on into different companies, but I didn't want to leave the city because I was working in TV and film. And so they said, well, you know, we're going to have to let you go because, you know, you're the one who probably will survive without suffering like the others would. So that was it. And then after that, it was one TV job after another, one film after another. And, you know, there was droughts, no doubt. But as you know, I think the highlight was probably Due South and then moving on to Degrassi, which we'll talk if you want about that. I don't want to jump ahead too far. But yeah, that's what got me into acting was realizing that, hey, you could get paid for it. And B, you could attract girls. Oh my God.
Hey, look, if you're not getting into it, at least on some level, to attract the opposite, same sex, whatever it may have you that you're into.
Yeah.
And you're doing it wrong, quite frankly. unless it's not your thing again, but you know.
Yeah.
You're what's into that kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm not into, you know, literature and messages. I'm just into having fun.
So try and be inclusive. I know some people are asexual. I know some people, like, but whatever you're into, if you're not going into it for it, you know, you're making a mistake as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you know, share the love.
So, I did want to ask you just a little bit about kind of the fact that you have worked in loads of franchises. So, amongst the ones, some which I read out before you, Heroes Reborn, it was Degrassi in all its different permutations, I think, just about. RoboCop, Kung Fu, Total Recall. Did you have any favorite experiences from going to those other kind of amazing franchises?
Wow. You know, some of the titles you brought up are just like, they were so much fun. I remember, like, for example, I think it was Total Recall, or I can't remember. I was an arms dealer and I got to handle all these weapons, and I can't remember. Maybe it was Total Recall. I can't remember, but I handled, you know, Uzis and AK-47s. That was fun. Heroes Reborn. These little things as actors that, they make you feel magical. I remember in Heroes Reborn, I played a real seedy, shady, evil doctor who took advantage of a young woman, but I had powers. And in the show, I demonstrated my powers to her by I swatted a fly, I killed a fly, and the fly's on the little side table. And then I put my finger on the fly and it brought it back to life. And in reality, it was a real fly, because what they do is they had a fly.
And you actually brought a fly back to life.
I did.
I knew your powers were great, but now we're really discovering.
Well, it's amazing. These are the things that Paul never let me incorporate into the show because he didn't want me to steal the spotlight from him.
Sure, you don't want some powers of resurrection in there? No? Okay, I'll leave them on the table then. Fine. That's what you want.
But truth be told, this is what it was. We have wranglers. You know, it could be rabbit wranglers, dog wranglers. There was a guy with a picnic cooler full of flies. And they were cold. So when they're cold, they fall asleep, right? So they would put the asleep fly on the table and the warmth from my finger would revive it. So it's a close-up of me putting my finger on the fly, and then suddenly it just shakes its wings and flies off. So I'm demonstrating to this person that I have special powers. So that the little things like that, you know, give you such a buzz. Handling weapons, bringing flies back to life, flying off buildings, which I haven't done yet. But those are the memories I have. Shows like Heroes Reborn was like that. And handling the weapons, I think it was in Total Recall. Driving cars and shooting guns in Due South and being really macho and all that. I mean, that's a lot of laughs, you know. And I've done doctors too. Now I do old doctors, which we can touch upon later. Some couple of the movies that are about to be have been released, but we'll talk later about that if you wish.
Oh yeah, we'll definitely get into that. But yeah, I do feel like we have to at least pay some due to Degrassi. It is such a legend over there and in America.
Yeah,
not really ever kind of made it over here. I'm sure you can get it on some of the streamers, but tell us a bit about that and kind of just getting to be in such an iconic show.
Yeah, well, you know, I agree with you using that term iconic, because I'm very fortunate to be a part of Due South and Degrassi, which, you know, they're going to be in Canada's history forever because of what they've done to the industry. So Degrassi, in 1988, while I was with the comedy troupe Second City, I played a small role in one of their incarnations or permutations of it called Degrassi Junior High. They had Kids of Degrassi, then Degrassi Junior High. So I played a mechanic on that show. Did my little one, two or three day role. They asked me back, but I said, no, I just joined the union. They were non-union, so I couldn't do that. And then some years later, that same producer, the same company, they did a show, sort of, it was an attempt to be a Canadian version of Coronation Street called Riverdale. And I came on that show as a private detective, kind of like a Harrison Ford, Sam Spade type of detective, a womanizer, all the above. It was a lot of fun doing that show. And then that show died. And then within a year, they called me. The same producer said, look, we're bringing Degrassi back. Would you like to just do us a favor and appear as a teacher? And I said, okay, just for fun, I'll do it. And next thing you know, 16, 17 seasons. Well, I mean, I'd appear in about five, maybe eight episodes a season. What began is me just being the teacher who's assigning the lesson. And then the camera would follow the kids through that episode, dealing with whatever controversial subject they dealt with. But eventually I started you know, sneaking in some of my Deweyisms, some of my Tom Angles, my irreverence. And the writers picked up on that. And the character became a teacher that was grumpy and rude, a tough love teacher. And a lot of the kids started to resonate with that teacher because they thought, you know, I've had a teacher like that who appeared very crusty, but beneath it all was very caring, compassionate for the students. And you know, what was like a cameo developed. I mean, I've done two podcasts with them already, and I get stopped on, not as often as I used to, but I'd be stopped on the street and people would say, hey, did you teach at such and such high school? Because they thought I was really their high school teacher. I'd say, you know, I'm in Atlanta or I'm in Northern Ontario. And they would say, were you a teacher at my school? And I say, no, I taught at Degrassi. And they go, oh my God, it's Mr. Perino. Oh, so the show has had a surprisingly big impact, more than I thought. Due South was totally expected because it was already a legendary show when I joined it. And Everything about it was iconic, you know, the work that Paul did, Callum, David previous to that, Catherine Brouillet, all those actors, you know, were solid actors. And the writing was amazing. I mean, I look back at the reruns now, even with my wife and son, and we still laugh. We laugh. Even if I'm not in the show, we still enjoy it because the writing is so crisp, so sharp. And jump onto that show. And with Degrassi, you know, my character was spread out and that. It's not really per se an adult show, although I get some of the kids telling me I watch the show with my mom. She thinks you're handsome. So it was my character is more or less for the mothers who are watching the show.
Wow. Very quickly, we have got AK Murphy has put, yes, Mr. Perino.
There you go.
And Mr. Peter Melissus.
That sounds familiar. That's my brother. My older brother, who's a frustrated performer in his own way. He's a very funny guy, and he runs a karaoke business in just outside of Cornwall, Ontario, and Alexandra. Look him up. Book him. He's really good. Good DJ and karaoke guy.
Excellent. And just very quickly before we get off Degrassi, was there a particular favorite episode, a favorite thing which you got to do in that role?
In Degrassi?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'll just tell you what. The character was just a teacher popping in and out. And in one episode, they featured me. And out of the blue, they said, you're going to be starring in this episode. And you're a really mean, abusive teacher. Suddenly, I'm a mean, abusive teacher. Up until then, I was very, very soft-spoken. So I had this episode where I was bullying one of the kids and I got suspended. And I thought to myself, oh, that's it. I'm done. They're not bringing me back. This is Mr. Perino, the teacher's been suspended. And I thought, well, you know, Degrassi, every time they'd end a season with this huge catastrophe, like a school bus crashing on a field trip. And, you know, who are they going to make it? Join us next season, you know? So I thought, oh, they're going to bring back my character and I'm going to be shooting the kids in the hallway out of revenge. That's what I thought. But it didn't happen. The following season, they just brought me back with no explanation. And my attitude was, why am I back? What happened? Did you not? And I said, okay, you don't care. I don't care. And I had that attitude of like, whatever. Hey, girls and boys, you have an essay due tomorrow. Good luck. And the writers picked up on that. And then from then on, they said, this grumpy guy, we're going to throw him in all sorts of situations to see if he'll crack. So to your point about, was there a particular episode? Well, that episode pivoted, facilitated the development of my character. So that from then on, there's all these episodes where in the middle of a class, one of the young ladies is lactating. She's pregnant. She's lactating in my class. And I could see that, you know, her breast areas are staining. And I had to go, you have to leave my class. And she says, no, I have a pump. I can pump here in class. And I'm like, no. And another episode, someone throws coffee at me or someone brings a pet pig or all these crazy things that happen in my episodes just to see how this grumpy guy would respond. And I loved it because it put me on the spot. And so to your point, well, there's no particular favorite episode. There's all these little moments of watching this particular teacher get egg on his face. And that's what I loved about it.
And I mean, I'm going to like ask something which I'm kind of like I'm interested in, but also it's slightly self-motivated here because I'm about to step on the stage myself for the first time in a number of years. And it's playing it's quite a challenge. It's a play called Blue Remembered Hills. So it's older actors playing kids. during the World War, and there's kind of some quite a lot of darkness to it. Wow. And something which I've always observed about you, you're so such a friendly, avuncular person yourself, and kind of to play someone as grumpy and as dark as it that teacher from Degrassi sounded like he could be, how do you kind of channel into something like that?
That's a great question. You know, as you grow up, as we grow old, we discover different facets of ourselves. You know, sometimes there's a part of you that's very eager to be liked. Sometimes there's a part of you that's very compassionate. Sometimes a part of you, they're just fed up. Sometimes you just get fed up. I mean, these are different elements of our characters. And so whenever you read a part, and if there's something about that character you can resonate with, if they're always upbeat, but you're having a miserable day, deal with it. Get the miserable part of it and say, look, the guy who's upbeat's having a bad day, but today he's going to turn it around. So find that within you that resonates with the character and follow that path. Now, at the same time, follow that path, but also consider there could be a surprise. One minute he's grumpy, and the next minute he actually cracks a smile. And that gives characters layers. And I've told this before. My Degrassi character teacher he reminded me of a teacher I had in 7th and 8th grade. He was a real grumpy bastard. But one day I ripped my knee in the schoolyard and he took me into his office and with tenderness and care dressed the wound on my knee. And he also demonstrated a sense of humor. And I realized, wow, you can be all these things. You know, you can be grumpy and you can be happy, you can be silly, whatever it is. So, but what you're saying, going to a place of darkness, for lack of better words, that can be quite daunting, right? Because it's not like you're a musician and you pack up your instrument at the end of the day and put it in the closet. No, your instrument is your body and your mind and your soul, your heart. So when you're working in that area, you have to find a way to decompress and leave it at the office, so to speak. So, you know, are there things in your life that make you feel sad? Are there things in your life that make you feel angry? Well, you know, tap on those and see if you could bring that into the work and play with it. That's my note to you. There you go. Good luck. Sounds like it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Now I've got pro tips here, so I can't complain too much. Quickly, Peter did just say, still funny, I see. Thanks. I'm not relating to the last bit, but previously. I'm going to assume there. Right, so we are going to get into Due South in just a minute, guys. I haven't forgotten, don't worry. I just like to get into the kind of bigger world of these wonderful actors, which I'm privileged enough to interview. One I did want to ask you about, and I'm sure some people at least have come wanting to hear the story of this. Tell me about TNT with Mr. T playing Giles and Ned. A dual role versus Mr. T. Come on.
Okay, that's funny. Yeah. Sometimes, you mentioned about Canada being so vast and the opportunities to act are so small. Well, there's some TV series we had here where, you know, you're fortunate enough to come back as a different character in the same show. So I played two different characters, different episodes. Now, the first one, was a real slick guy in a really, it's like an ivory colored suit, like a pimp, drug dealer, gangster, really glasses, really cool, collected. And the other one was just the opposite. He was really disheveled. On a spousal abuser, violent type of person. Both of them were a lot of fun to play because I was in my own fantasy world. And in one of the episodes where I played the real abuser, disheveled guy, that's where I worked with Mr. T. And we fought. I fought Mr. T.
You got a fight scene with Mr. T. Come on. Like, yeah. That's going to be bucketlistic, Doctor.
Well, he was funny. He had a double who rehearsed some things with me, and his double accidentally punched me, almost cracked my jaw. But I just remember one outtake with Mr. T. He came on set and he looked at the TV that was in my apartment. He goes, "We used to steal that when we were kids." And I said, "Oh, okay." And so the scene is he comes bursting into the door to save the damsel, the young woman who I was taking advantage of. And I was supposed to pull my gun from out of my back of my pants. And the pants were so disheveled and baggy that the gun fell all the way down through past my butt, down into my ankle. So he's like, "What are you waiting for?" And I just went, "My gun fell down my pants." <It's> cut. And then the scene continues. We did. I held the gun up to him and he slaps out of my hand and he just knocks me out cold.
Excellent. And like, yeah, just to put that in context, for anyone who hasn't clicked yet, that's Sylvester Stallone as Rocky and Tom Lissis got to fight against like Mr. T. Come on.
Wow. Come on, oh, that's right. There you go.
Just think of it like that. Come on.
The other thing you brought up was Kung Fu. Kung Fu, the legend continues. That's David Carradine as his character that he did in the original series. And I did two episodes of that. And I think in one of the episodes, he did beat us up. So I got beaten up by Mr. T and by David Carradine.
It's not bad. It's not bad. It's all I'm saying. And by the way, for anyone whose question I haven't read out yet, I might be saving it to pair it up with another one, which is coming up. So just so no one thinks I'm ignoring them. Peter does have a question, though. And who am I to say no to your brother? Did you chat about Ready or Not? We haven't yet. What's Ready or Not? Tell me about that one.
That was a TV series, short-lived, a few seasons. I did the pilot. I played a teacher on that, and it's kids, sixth graders, not high school. And it's the journey of this young sixth grade girl and her best friend going through puberty, adolescence. And I was their teacher for a short time. I don't know what became of the show. I know I did the pilot and lasted for about 4 episodes. And it's not around anymore. But there's still a fan base out there. I have a few people that follow me on Instagram who are fans of the show, Ready or Not.
Amazing. So I'm sorry, but some of these, like, this is what kind of is really interesting. It's when I was interviewing Catherine Brier previously, and some of the shows I said is like, I don't know. I understand this is huge in Canada, but they didn't make it over here. So it's kind of interesting to hear about kind of these parallel worlds where a show's absolutely huge, but it just doesn't make it over here. Getting onto the juice out of it all. I did want to ask, John Wright has sent in a question, your friend of mine from the Due South events.
Yeah.
So I'm going to wind this out. He's asked about auditioning and memories of going for Ray Kowalski, which you auditioned for. But
wow.
If you tell us about the whole auditioning process as well while we're on that.
Yeah.
That
area. Okay. Well, when Due South first started, before the first pilot, I was originally auditioning for Vecchio. And they flew me and a couple other buddies out to California, Los Angeles, for a screen test. I was overwhelmed. I was young and didn't get the role, which is fine. And then so the show got on its feet, got going. And then I auditioned for Detective Louie and didn't get that. And the show continued on. And then the show shut down, as you know. Yeah. And then when they brought it back, they invited me to audition for Kowalski. And I met with Paul. We sat down, we talked. I did a screen test with him. Didn't get that. And then, I was really, really feeling good, saying, you know what? That was a lot of fun experience versus when I did it 4 years before in LA. I was a lot more calmer this time. So I felt myself arriving at a different plateau with my work and my well-being. So I remember at my apartment lying there, I think I was just lying on the floor meditating, just relaxing. I got the phone call. And it was Paul. Paul phoned me directly and he said, look, we haven't decided if you're going to be Ray Kowalski, but you're in the running. However, would you be interested in playing a detective, Detective Dewey? And he's the one who replaces Daniel Cash, who was Louie. And I said, okay, Paul, that sounds like a win-win situation. Either way, I'm in, and I'm all for it. He said, fine, great, see you soon. And that was it. That was my path to Due South, becoming Detective Thomas Dewey.
You see, I think that's such an important thing, not only for actors, but also for anyone who's kind of trying anything, and it can be difficult, and you can try out loads of times. And it can be about the energy you keep on coming in with, and you find new energy to bring in, and just kind of sticking with something can really make that difference. Because especially with acting, as I understand from the kind of actors I've interviewed on this show, it just seems to be the ones who kind of make it, like they realize that even if they don't take you for that role, they might have really liked you. It's just they didn't see that role in you, but they want you for something else. And the more you get your face in front of them, the more things you get to show them. And even if you're not showing them that on that day, if you've shown it in a previous audition, they get to put that all together in their mind. So that seems like a really important thing for an actor.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's well said. I know that even while I was on Due South and I've been on other shows, TV series, etc., a lot of my actor friends would say, oh, man, I've auditioned for that show like 10 times. They've never booked me. And I would explain them and say, look, they're bringing you in because they like you. They're bringing you in. The casting person has faith in you, and you're making the casting person look good, because producers, if they see a wide range of talent, they'll just go, wow, the casting person is doing their job. And you make them look good by showing up. And as you said, there's a quality about you that they like. They're trying, they're hoping, and, you know, come close or down the road, the next project. So just do your work. Enjoy doing it, and do it for yourself. Don't go. I mean, it's a trap we all fall into. We go, how did I do? What do they want? What are they looking for? And it's easy to get trapped into that. And it's like a blind date. You go, oh my God, what should I do? What are they looking for? How should I behave? No, but if you just go, look, I'm just here to share of myself, share of my work. And if they enjoy it, fantastic. If they don't, that's okay. You walk away feeling good about what you did. And that's easier said than done, because I've been in that trap where I'm going, oh, why didn't I do that? I could have done that. Well, it just eats you up. My motto is, if, you know, the reason you got the job is the same reason you didn't get the job. These are things you can't control.
There's something I want to ask you about while we're on the kind of auditioning process, and how the kind of show reinvented itself after the original Ray left in the form of David. Something which Tony Craig mentioned when he was on the show was the fact that there was at one stage talk of making it a double act with his character going ahead, as instead of bringing in another Ray, they were going to bring forward Jack Huey as the kind of partner up. It was actually the BBC which apparently poo-pooed it, and for what sound like not great reasons, to be frank.
Right.
But I was just wondering if you're aware of that, if you heard about
that's the first time. I've ever heard of that. And you know, that's not a bad thing, because within shows you can move your parts around, your people around, right? That to me would have been been fun to watch. But that's the first I've heard of it. And like I said, there's the reason you got the job for the same reason you didn't get the job, because what goes on behind those doors, sometimes you want to know, sometimes you don't want to know, and just move on.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it sounds like it was for very much the wrong reasons it didn't happen. But, you know, anyone check out the interview, Tony tells it. I don't feel like it's my place to say anything further on that. But there we go. Yeah, and talking about Tony Craig, what an amazing actor. Like, and he a musician as well. What was it like playing off him? And now I know you're a musician yourself. How was it comparing notes?
Well, that's a stretch. I was I did eventually drum, as because we lost our drummer, and I self-taught. But the reason I bring that up is because Tony is a phenomenal musician. He's a phenomenal drummer, you know, trained. And I mean, he was the guy. To me on the show, he was like a big brother to me. I mean, he'd been on the show before. He'd tell me this and that and how to, you know, just watch yourself. And I was getting really anxious. I really wanted to get going. They held us back for a few episodes before we got my character going. And Tony could sense my frustration. And in a way, he was telling me, look, that happened to Daniel too. He said, Daniel was getting over anxious and wanted more. And it didn't pan out the way he wanted it to. But Tony was very good that way. And we'd sit and talk about stuff. Like, it just blew my mind. Whenever certain established musicians or bands like Ray Charles or whatever would come to Toronto to play, they would sometimes call upon him to step in and drum. And I just blew me away. And I think more, getting back to that concert hall I worked at, Massey Hall, I imagine I probably saw Tony before I met him, because there were bands that were playing at that, on that stage, R&B bands and whatever, that he mentioned. And I thought, oh, so maybe you're actually, he goes, yeah, I filled in at Massey Hall. I filled in the recording sessions. So he was an amazing guy. His presence is, I don't know, there's something about him. To me, it was like a big brother. And I really loved having him sharing. We'd hang on each other's trailer, and he'd be playing Caribbean steel drum music, which at some point would drive me crazy. But it was phenomenal. It was just, we played off each other very well, because he was so grounded. He was like a giant oak tree. And I was like a little hummingbird and I was just like, ooh. And he's like,
yeah,
Tom, relax.
Yeah, I mean, just and such cool energy. When I was interviewing him, he's like, I find just something about someone who is so relaxed and staid as a person, because I'm more like yourself when it comes to that. I've got ADHD myself, and it's like I've got kind of very high energy and stuff.
Me too.
So when someone is more, when someone is more relaxed, it's just so fascinating to me. And I just, I love that discipline of it. But it was kind of interesting. One thing which me and Michelle have been noticing, we've just sort of got onto the third series of Due South, going back and talking about it for the show. When you come in, the relationship between the two other detectives, which you're a part of in that dynamic, and the two lead ones, in the earlier series, it seems more competitive. It's kind of interesting what happens when your character comes in. Of it does become a bit more kind of like a collaborative. They have some episodes where they kick off against each other, but mainly they seem to work together a bit more. Like you get them all that sibling relationship. Was that something you were conscious of? Was that something that happened with the NG you brought, or was that something that they just wrote into it at that stage?
I think it was organic. I think there was energy that collided. I think some of the early episodes that we shot were out of sequence. The actual episode that you see me for the first time was shot months after we started shooting. So I was really discombobulated as to what were you doing? I mean, I thought, are you giving me old scripts of Daniel's dialogue? You know, I was getting a sense of that, and there was a surliness, and I was getting, as I told you, I was getting very anxious, and, you know, was I resentful? Was it, oh, you know, part of me was like, why did they hire Callum? Why'd they hire him? You know? So I had this energy of envy, and Tony was like, calm down. So by the time we got to that scene where you first meet my character, yeah, you know, Callum and I, he threw me on the hood of the car. And afterwards, Callum said to me, I sensed there was a little hostility there, Tom. And I said, well, maybe just a little. But leading up to, you know, we had before that, you know, we had a, Callum and I had a moment. I visited him in his trailer, and this was in the early episodes where, man, you know, the dialogue was heavy for him and Paul. And he this was new to him. And he said to me, oh, man, I think they're going to fire me. He was really questioning. And I said, really? I said, they're tired of me. I think they're going to fire me because they can't stand my eagerness to get going. You know, in the early episodes we shot, I was just getting a few lines here, a few lines there, up until the episode in which you saw me. But Callum was having doubts, and that was a little bonding moment for us, because by the time the series got going between us, we had already had a connection that we cared for each other, and I had great admiration for him because I'd seen his previous movies, and the guy is such a presence, and he's so edgy. You know, love that about him. He has an edge about him, a sense of danger. And that's, I have a bit of that. Listen to me, I'm a wimp, but I do have a street edge to me, and I really gravitated to that side of Callum's. So by the time we got to interact with that, we were pretty much bonded, and we could trust each other. And we had a few laughs. I think off the top of my head, I remember the Christmas episode where I give him a ray gun for Christmas. And we looked at each other. I realized that look we shared, we both just burst out laughing, was much like what a journey we've been on. You know, this ups and downs, the demands placed upon us. And here we are with a toy gun in our hand, and we look at each other. And it was a genuine moment. I mean, I laughed, he laughed. And it was a nice way to solidify that relation between the two, combative as it was, you succinctly pointed out. And there are moments where, you know what, we look out for each other and we care for each other as characters and as people, as actors. So that was an interesting development going on amongst all of us. And it was organic, as I said, it just developed, writers picked up on it and ran with it.
And AK's just said that's one of her favorite moments. So,
wow, that's awesome. I appreciate that, because it was for me too.
So another one from John, he's put, were there any jokers, troublemakers on the set?
Besides myself? yeah, I think I was the one who was a thorn in everyone's side. I used to say things that were so obtuse, say things that were so non sequitorial, and they'd all look at each other and go, what the hell are you talking about, Tom? Because at my ADHD, I didn't know I had it back then. I would leap steps ahead and say things like, you know, the one gag was called, I said something about, yeah, I keyed it up, you're going to have your own skillet. And people go, what the F do you mean skillet, Tom? I said, well, don't you remember in the movie Goodfellas where Paul Sorvino is in prison and he's making an Italian dish and he has his own skillet and he's privileged because he's a mobster. He has his own skillet and he's cooking, chopping up garlic and making homemade pasta sauce. And they went, that's how you arrived at Skillet? Yeah. So there was a running gag when there was someone say something stupid, you know, Bo or Paul or Cam would go, Skillet. And they, you know, it was their way of saying, oh, someone just says something really out there that makes no sense. So the reference was to myself. And I think during the holidays, I went out and bought all these little camper skillets and engraved their names on them and gave them out as holiday gifts. Which is weird. Yeah.
That's definitely a laugh of recognition from me, trust me. I would be the one in the skillet moment.
Yeah, we do funny things when you're ADHD.
Oh, yeah.
We're in our own world.
Regina Keem, a good friend of the show, she's asked, what was it like to join the cast of Due South halfway through the run? Any difficulties? Did you know the cast already and the show? That bit's added by me the later bit.
That's an awesome question. Yeah, I knew about the show. I thought the show was really overwhelmingly good and really sharp. And I, when I showed up on set, I mean, I was in awe. I mean, you stand beside someone like Paul, he's like a porcelain doll. He's so damn handsome. You just want to touch his face and make sure he's real because he's just so. And the thing that blows you away with Paul is that he's so damn good looking, but he's really smart and he's very talented. I mean, we were doing episodes. I do a take with Paul and he'd rush off to the side and start working, typing out the next episode. And I'd be going, what am I doing with this person? I mean, they're in a league of their own and I'm beside him cracking jokes and he's nailing his lines, nailing his blocking, doing everything right. And then writing the next episode. And I'm like, so I was overwhelmed when I first went on set. I just looked at Paul and looked at Calmet. I remember saying something that they just gave me a dirty look one time because they were so overwhelmed with the work because they were trying to get the show off the ground because they have new cast. Trying to get the chemistry with Paul and Callum going. And I walked on set and I saw them and I could see that they both looked tired. And, you know, ADHD, you have no filter. So I just said, wow, you guys look tired. You okay? And Paul just looked at me and goes, oh, really? Thanks. Thanks for the compliment, Tom. And I go, oh, okay. They are tired. They are overworked. But I guess I didn't come across compassionate. But yeah, that was me putting my foot in my mouth. But that's the way it goes, you know?
Yeah. I don't like to sort of interview someone about someone else too much, but it's like, I am kind of fascinated about that because by the time you get to season 3 and 4, as it was blocked out in America and Canada, it was just released a one long series over here. But by the time you get to that stage, Paul Gross is writing it. He's directing kind of episodes. He's starring in it. He's doing the soundtrack to a lot of the episodes.
Yeah.
That just must have been incredible to be around. Like, was he still like, obviously he had his moments like that, but it sounds like he found the time to be personable to everyone as well.
I'm glad you brought that up because there was one, I remember we were shooting one episode and we had long hours and I don't know. Do you guys celebrate Halloween in
England? Yeah.
Well, this was
a bit bigger from the influence from America. But
okay.
Yeah.
So this was Halloween night and we were going long. And then it was announced we're shutting down early. And Paul said, I just haven't seen my children in a long time and I want to go out trick-or-treating with them. I want to go out and take them out. And I just went, oh, are you kidding me? This guy is a loving father. Fantastic actor, writing, producer. What the hell doesn't he do? I mean, is he on the Olympic swim team now? I don't know what's going on.
But I mean, he didn't manage to film that curling, so, you know, maybe he was in the Olympics as well.
Yeah, it's a good point. We should look at the films and see if he wasn't him winning those medals. But yeah, that was the moment I just went, you know, what a sweet, caring guy. And that's when I realized, you know, we're in good hands. And as the late George Bloomfield said, when we finished our last episode ever, he said, it's not going to get better than this. And he's right. Never. I've been on good shows. I've been on good series and there's some good caring atmosphere. But that's, I can't see anything better than the atmosphere created on that show, the camaraderie amongst the crew, the camaraderie amongst the cast. And it was a fun show to work on. Anytime I showed up, it was great. Even though we're outside in the pouring rain, you know, we still had good times, you know, working in the cold. It was still fun.
Well, you lead me very, very neatly onto the next question, which, by the way, all these great questions, but this one I particularly liked from Jackson Yee. So he's asked, did Due South have any impact on your life other than being a job?
Absolutely. I think I talked about it when I was on that show. I was, you know, young. You know, age as a number, and I just felt I was emotionally immature in so many levels. And I felt that there was a time there I was getting borderline snarky, and just like, I want to be using the show more. What are they waiting for? Come on, let's go. And Tony really took me aside. I said, look, calm down. Your time will come. You know, don't be that guy. And I was humbled. And I realized that, you know, like I said, he was like a big brother, but that was like a father-son moment because of my lack of emotional maturity. And not just as an actor, but as a person, I went, you know what? Sometimes you got to be aware of how you come off. You know, you may think you're funny or this or that, but sometimes step back and wait for your time. It'll come. And that for me was a pivotal moment for me as a person and as an actor, that Tony had the wherewithal to, you know, he didn't judge me. He just took me as I said, look, Tom, you're coming off a little eager, sometimes abrasive. Just be careful. And I apologized to some of the crew. I said, look, I've been really hyper and all that. And they're like, okay, all right, you say so. I don't know if they saw me being abrasive or they're just stunned by the fact that I confess and say, I apologize. I'm going to be more relaxed. And from then on, pretty chill. And we had fun. And that was, that was probably something I came away with from that show. It was about being professional and being a very caring person and an actor.
And I think that that's very much an ADHD thing. And it kind of links back to what we were saying before about kind of Tony's stillness. I think that when someone gives you that energy, when your brain does work a million miles an hour, that gift of that stillness can be really profound, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's very calming. And, and from that comes a power, you know, there's a power from it. So, but you know, even as an actor now, I teach acting and I say, you got to come from that place of stillness because that gives you the foundation to fly off and come back. You know, fly off and come back. And that's a balance I've put into my work of late, into my life, you know, being a father of a 14-year-old boy and being a partner to my lovely wife. I've learned so much as a person and putting my career aside and focusing on being a better father, a better person and a better partner to my wife and having responsibility and, you know, getting the acting jobs, not the be all end all. Sometimes, though, it's fun to get one. And the process is there, but it's the holistic approach to living, which I think is important. And that is, it comes from just sitting in your body, being comfortable in the uncomfortableness and being comfortable when it's comfortable, you know, stillness, as you say, which is lovely. So well put.
Thank you. Regina's put, it sounds like Tony has been a great partner on and off screen.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're not in touch anymore. I mean, I see him on Facebook occasionally, but that period of time and through the conventions too. It was great to see him at the conventions. The conventions have been a lot of fun. People I met through the conventions are fantastic. The organizers, John Wright and Stefan Reichel, they've been great. And the people I've connected to, as I said, some of the ones I met in England while I was there, they've been fabulous. And the conventions, you know, hanging out with Ramona. I still keep in touch with Ramona. Love her dearly. And Camilla, I don't see much of, but Tony through Facebook, through the social media, I see what he's up to. And he's out there. He's still Tony, which is great. You can just tell he's still Tony.
Yeah. And like, while we are on the conventions, John did say, I better ask you about that. The gala dinners, the charity auctions. How were those events? Everyone still talks about them so fondly.
Well, they were just... That was my first taste, for lack of a better word, stardom. You know, while we're filming halfway through the series, the mayor of Toronto claimed a Due South Day. We were out at a park, and there was crowds and people signing autographs and all that. And that's when I first started to meet some of the fans. And then I got invited to a convention, and you're sitting on a panel and they're out there and the flash bulbs are going off, cameras going off. You know, there's people going, okay, he's entered the building. He's here now. He's in the lobby. Shall we escort him? He's traveling. Here we go. I'm like, whoa. And it really puffs up your ego. It really does. And then what brings it back down to earth is when you sit and look at the supporters of the show, the viewers of the show, and they're people. They're just regular folks. And you get to see what they're doing with their lives and where they're from, and it grounds you. And that's the part I get a kick out of. Even with Degrassi, it's just like people say, I love your work. And I go, thank you for saying that, and thank you for watching. Because the industry, without an audience, what are we, you know? So the conventions have been fabulous. They have trivia games. They have prizes, auctions. I mean, I donate stuff, and people purchase it and they treasure it, hang on to it. And it's better they have it because, you know, I have to declutter now and then. So I have to unload stuff. But yeah, just signing autographs. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. That's a buzz. It's overwhelming sometimes. And it's like, whew, you know, but then you realize how the work you do, that you collaborate with the other actors and artists, how it impacts people's lives. I know there's several people. Same with Degrassi. Some people said that show, whether it's Due South or Degrassi, guided me through some rough times during my childhood.
Yeah.
Or it was a time that the family got together and watched and we were bonded. And then you kind of go, yeah, you're in people's homes. And it impacts you, right? And that's what I love about it. I go, that's what art is, whether it's written, painted, whatever.
And the themes and the way they talk about things in Due South, obviously things like the wonderful 90s fashion maybe doesn't live on to this day, but like the themes and the way it's kind of plotted and the kind of mission of kindness in the show, just that's so universal. It just, it's still as fresh today to watch as it was back then.
Yeah. Yeah, it is smart. And it is a challenge. I mean, it's a, you know, it was a police show, but some people say, okay, it didn't have the grit and all that, which I can understand that. But it's a real challenge to find that balance. And it's, you know, there's a lightheartedness to it, a cleverness to it. But there's also, you know, you talk about power and stillness. I mean, Fraser.
Yeah. And like, you know, how many shows can we point to which have got grit? But how many can we point to who've got that much heart, who've got kindness, as I say, baked? Like, thank you kindly is literally his motto, like his catchphrase on the show. I think that's okay to represent something a bit different.
Yeah.
Don't always have to be just the gritty. But it had its moments of grit at the same time. So
It did. And Paul's character was about stability, was about calm, was about do not panic. It's going to work out. And, you know, that's just like straight ahead, you know, stiff upper lip. Here we go. Right. Probably why the show appealed to so many in the UK. Right. And
we will worship the Queen.
Right. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Tammy's just put, I'm bummed I've never been able to make it to a convention. Totally me too. If they do another one, I'm definitely there.
Well, maybe someday I'll do a tour. Tell me where you all live, and you know, if you have a spare room, I'll map out a tour and drop by.
Sounds like a plan. And Tammy did have a question, which I haven't featured yet, which I will also bring in Sarah Kirk's comment at this point. Love the cat who keeps appearing in the background. And Tammy's question was actually, do you like cats? Well, we know you like cats. Tell us about your cat. Tell us about your kind of love of cats.
Well, let me see here. There he is. Hey, Oliver.
Hello, Oliver.
Sleeping on the bench. Oddly enough, yeah, I didn't think I'd be a cat person, but we had two kittens, Oliver and Panu. They're a brother and sister. And Panu, we had to let go, put down over a year, 2 years ago. And we have Oliver. There's something about them that's very calm. I used to love picking him up all the time, but now because he has claws and he loves to do love bites, I can't pick him up. I have to cuddle somehow their way with him. My wife will put a towel on her shoulder and put him on there, and that way his claws won't dig in. But sometimes he's so aggressive. This guy, he's demanding. He wants to be picked up now. And when you go approach him, he'll, nope, don't want you to go today. But today he caught a mouse. He caught a mouse today. We are proud of him. We were dealing with some mice, and we thought we'd got rid of them all, but somehow he ended up finding one. So cats, there's something, you know, dogs are awesome. You know, they don't grow up. Cats do, and they can be aloof, but they're very very calming in their own way. So yeah, I guess I'm a cat person.
And Sarah says hello, Oliver.
He's napping. Oliver's napping.
Congratulations to Oliver on his
on his conquest.
We've got Minnesota. So you've got Minnesota and Southampton so far. We want you okay. to come on the tour. While we're speaking of the Animal Kingdom, of course, I can't let anyone who's been on Due South go without telling me about working with the Diefenbakers. I believe you're on the second Diefenbaker when you came into the show.
Yeah. Tony told me about the first Diefenbaker. They used to call that first Diefenbaker OT because they have problems hitting their mark and it just added hours onto the day and they went into overtime all the time. The second Diefenbaker, I didn't do much with Diefenbaker, although I just, such an adorable dog. I remember at the wrap party, I sat with, there's probably a picture of me with Diefenbaker licking my face at one of the parties. And the dog was so sweet and so particular, very specific and professional. And I thought, wow, how did they get a dog to do that? I mean, I've worked with flies, but working with a dog like that was a totally different trip. I didn't have that much interaction with Diefenbaker, but watching in the episodes, yeah, that dog was hitting the mark all the time and put a lot of us to shame.
That's brilliant. Another question from John. Anything in the role that you didn't get a chance to, which is quite interesting in the context of what you were saying about learning to be more given the role, but was there something you really want to, like you would have liked to have cheesed if the show had gone longer?
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I know, oddly enough, we ended with Tony and I opening up our own comedy club. That would have been interesting if I kept going down that path and my character kept going down that path, could be, you know, a part-time stand-up comedian and part-time private eye. You know, who knows that where that would have went, you know, because you know, comedy clubs can be just as complex, crime-ridden, all sorts of crazy characters, crazy stuff that goes on behind the scenes. I've been to a few comedy clubs behind the scenes, and yeah, they can be pretty aggressive and competitive, and they can be also loving. But yeah, that would be interesting what happened to. We did, at one of the conventions, we touched upon it, that if we came back to the show, in its form that it was, oddly enough, we're so old now, but as Paul would be seeing, and now of course Gordon Pinson has passed on, which is sad, but had he continued, Paul would be seeing Gordon Pinsett and I'd be seeing Daniel. I'd be seeing the ghost of Huey or Louie, sorry, the ghost of Louie. And that would have been only me seeing, I'd be haunted by Daniel Cash as Louie and no one else could see him. That was something we thought about at the convention. It could have been fun.
Well, apparently there was I've got a note here. Apparently, John did pitch an idea for a spin-off, Rio 5-0 spin-off series with Don Johnson and yourself and John and Hugh Grant as the bumbling sidekicks.
Oh, that's we don't have enough money to convince John to leave Australia. So that show is on hold. But that would have been a lot of fun. John and I riff about that a lot. We talk about the fun it would be to do something as cheesy as that. I think John came up with the idea when he saw me. There was a TV movie I did with David Hasselhoff where I played a helicopter police patrol guy and John Hasselhoff was my partner or something. And I think that's where John thought we could do a series, something like that. And well, it's still in the works, John. We just haven't raised enough money to afford you.
Regina said great idea for reboot. I think all great ideas. And I'm sorry, I was looking in my notes because you mentioned the reboots and things of the like. And I'm sorry for whoever gave the question, but I don't have a note of who it was. But someone did ask about the reboot. Have you been approached? Have you spoken to anyone about the idea of the reboot of Due South, which has been mooted over the last few years?
Well, no. Oddly enough, the first and only time I've heard of it was, I believe, when David Marciano, he came out and said that there was something in the works. And I think it had to do with their something like not necessarily them, but some their offspring or something to that effect. I don't know exactly what it was, but I heard nothing more than that. And to this day, it's time is ticking. You know, we're not spring chickens, and you would have to probably do what they do with Magnum PI or something else. There's shows like that where it's the younger version of it. That would, you know, you could find some But you know, to be a little off topic, there is that recurring theme of that type of character what Paul created. I mean, there's a show here in Toronto that's broadcast different parts of it called Murdoch Mysteries, and right. the lead detective is very much the way Paul was, very stoic, and that has a certain archetype that is very timeless. So reboots, yeah. I mean, there are shows we've had with Mounties in it, but none that. I mean, the comedic timing Paul has, the ability he has to go from comedic and into something very poignant is unmatched by a lot of shows I've seen. So you can't do a reboot of Due South without him, or you have to find someone close to him, or I don't know. It'd be fun to revisit it. I don't know where Tony and I would land, whether we'd have our comedy club / private eye investigator and they'd come back to us to help us. You know, who knows? I'm open for it. Keep the letters coming in.
Awesome. Another question from Sarah Kirk. I do want to just give a shout out because she never missed an episode of this and she's always shouting out the show and everything. So thank you very much for that, Sarah. Was it your idea for the lockdown Zoom chats?
Yes.
And tell us about those.
well, the lockdown was very daunting for a lot of us. It was surreal. Think about it now. It happened so many years ago. And, you know, my wife ran a dance school via Zoom. She kept her dance school alive. I was teaching via Zoom. And I thought, you know what? I'm familiar with it. I don't get to see people that much. I'm with my son. We walk in the park. We may see people and keep our social distance. And I thought, why not put it out there? I want to know what some of the Due South fans were doing. And we had a pretty good response. We'd get half a dozen people at a time. And we'd find out ways to entertain ourselves. I do remember one of the broadcasts, I guess for lack of better words, I said, okay, next week, bring an object from your house, some inanimate object, and we'll try to guess what it is. You know, so people brought all sorts of odd things, and I can't remember who it was. It might have been Christina in Sweden, I think it was. Could have been her. Some kind of weird type of potato peeler. I don't know. It was weird. But it was just a nice way to connect. Just to see how everyone was doing. We had different time zones. And I could see people were hungry for it. I was. It gave me a little buzz. And I loved chatting with people. And I did it for, I can't remember how long I did it. But after I had to discontinue it, I had to get on with other things. It continued amongst themselves. I think Diane Gross and I think Christina. And there were a few others. AK Murphy was also aboard.
Yeah,
there you go. They're still alive, run by Tina. There you go, Christina. She's the one who's behind it all right now, doing awesome.
And yeah, I mean, I found that kind of so fascinating during lockdown, where one of the nice things was people like yourself kind of reaching out to the fans and everything. Did that change your relationship with the fans going forward after that?
It enriched it, you know. Mm. It enriched it a lot more. I got to know what they did. I think I forget how to pronounce the name. Inez. They live in Germany, I think it was. Part volunteer firefighter.
Yeah.
Amazing, amazing artwork. You know, and then Diane does stitch work. And you get a sense of what they do. And I think it was AK Murphy, or could be someone else. I remember working whoever it is out there, they forgive me if for not remembering your name, but they worked in a hospital where they had all the equipment, surgical tools. They took care of those tools, instruments. And this is, you get to see what other people do besides being, you know, watching your show, the show you're on. They have a life that goes beyond that. And it's really, really cool to see that dynamic of the people out there. Like myself, you know, I got a cat. Yay, there you go. Who knew that? I play hockey. I teach acting.
And AK has put the Zoom chats were the best and we still do them weekly. Yeah, so awesome. Another shout out for the chats. I'm trying to get up. Sorry, I've just managed to lose my notes.
Doing great.
No, I've just managed to accidentally click on something and completely lose my notes halfway through the interview, so bear with me.
That's all right.
I've got my phone kind of on a little arm beside me here. I just want to make sure we get to as many of these wonderful questions. Thank you, everyone. You've really pulled out the bag with some great questions here. So we've got from Lynn Collinson, your friend of mine. in the picture. Oh yes, in the picture I used for this interview. I don't know if you remember seeing it when I was advertising this, but there's a picture of you with a gun, very dramatic. You've got a plaster on your finger. Do you remember where that Band-Aid came from?
No, I don't. I know. I you know, it's funny because I do have actually pictures still in my file of that, and I go, why didn't they just take the Band-Aid off? But then maybe they thought, oh, it looks really rugged. Maybe it was a wound.
I think it had.
A knife fight. I don't remember. I have no idea how I got it.
And another one from Lynn, actually. What was your favorite role to play, if Louis, which other one?
Ooh. I mean, if I wasn't Detective Dewey? Or
No. What was your favorite character to play? And I've just sort of added, if it is Louis... can you also give us another one? Because
aside from Due South, you mean what other characters?
Yeah, I'm adding that because I feel like that might be like one of your favorites, and we're talking about that one obviously in the main. So
yeah, Detective Dewey was fun. I'm trying to think of. I mean, you know, if you look at the body of work I've done, there is a commonality, a through line through all the characters, and there is a bit of a irreverent sense of humor. A bit of cockiness. I think there was a movie called The David Milgaard Story. I played a lawyer, which was pretty fascinating because it was based on a real story about a young man falsely imprisoned for 23 years. I played one of his lawyers, got him out. That was challenging because of the subject matter, because it dealt with real people, and I spent time with those actual people. That was really eye-opening and really heart-wrenching in some areas. The teacher again, Degrassi again. There's a certain irreverence. I don't know. It just happens innately. It's organically. I just bring that to a lot of the stuff I do. My last two movies I did, I played a doctor at a fertility clinic and a doctor at a maternity ward, and not so much humor. You know, just a very caring. You know, person, and that's a big change for me, without sneaking little quips in there. So, yeah, it's just I can't think of any particular role, but it was fun. You know, getting beaten up by Mr. T or David Carradine. These things are just, they stand out and they stay with me for a long time. They're out there somewhere in the waves. You can pick them up in some used DVD store, but I think Dewey was a lot of fun, and the teacher under Grassy was a lot of fun.
We've got a couple more comments from Peter, brother Peter here. I'm pretty sure I have the same shirt, Doug Squeed. Thank you very much. Yes.
Yeah, he does. I think
picked
he does.
Picked up at a lovely, it was new, but it was a lovely permanent flea market they had up the road from me. So shout out to the Mercantile Flea, sadly no longer with us. Peter's also said that was a great movie from you. So from Sarah, I enjoyed the Mary Higgins Clark TV film you did with Emma Sams and Buster.
Yeah.
Love the beard too. Tell us a bit about that then.
Wow, I forgot about that. That's amazing, Sarah. You're phenomenal. I had a beard because I did a movie that was totally improvised called Expecting, and Colin Mochrie was in that. My work was mediocre in that. The film was pretty good. And I had the beard, and I landed this part of this movie, the Mary Higgins story. And I was I can't remember now. I know we had a scene with Bo. We went face to face. I think he was the detective interviewing me as a suspect. And it was just too funny because I was sitting across from him. And Bo is Bo, man. His presence is huge. It's just such a – and he's one of those guys. He can be intimidating, but he has – a heart of gold, and there's a reverence about him, which is also charming. That was fun doing that. I just don't remember what else I did in that, except for my scene with Bo. And I did a scene with Bo's brother in another movie called Falcone. And that was about mobsters, based on our true story about Donnie Brasco, the guy who did that guy. He did a TV series here. And I was playing a bookie, and Bo's brother, I was giving him money or giving him a bets, and his brother says, hey, my brother tells me you're a nice guy. Okay, so I'll be nice to you. Because his brother is as big as Bo, if not bigger. So, yeah, that was fun. They pretend you don't see her is the name of that, Mary Higgins mystery. I guess there's a series of mystery stories. And I just remember being interviewed by Bo, and I could be cocky and really snotty with him, knowing that he wasn't going to, you know, punch me in the head, because he's such a kind, gentle person.
And what I love about doing these things live is you never know what questions people are going to.
I know. Oh my God.
And I love this. This is from Tammy. Did we ever find out why Chewie smells like fish all the time?
Well, his uncle sold fish. So maybe, yeah, I don't know. I could make it up. You know, you make up stuff. Yeah, he worked in his uncle's fish market all his life, and the smell never left him. And yeah, so he uses, I don't know, anchovy cologne. Don't know.
Getting onto the present and what you've got coming up. You did mention Doctors before, and you've got a movie version of that coming up. This is the UK Doctors for anyone who's watching over here. There is Canadian Doctors as well.
Well, there is my last two projects have spanned in terms of television. There's a movie called Revenge Delivered. It's a thriller, mystery thriller. I play a doctor at a maternity ward, and the doctor I work with, I look up to, apparently someone's stalking her and threatening her, and you try to find out who is doing that and for what reason. It's called Revenge Delivered. And then I just did a romantic comedy called Zoe's Having a Baby, and the role in that is much smaller, but I play a doctor at a fertility clinic that she approaches, and because she's a single woman who doesn't think she's ever going to find the right partner, wants to be artificially inseminated, and I help her through the process and tell her what to do, and then she ends up, I think, well, I don't want to give it away, but I can't give it away, who cares? No, she ends up falling in love with a man who's supporting her throughout this, and it turns out he was the mystery donor. Oops, just gave it away, too bad. And yeah, if you look them up, they're out there somewhere. They're available online, I think. Revenge Delivered, mystery thriller, and Zoe's Having a Baby, a romantic comedy.
And I alluded to earlier in the interview, so you've been in acting for 40 years, spanning over 5 decades, in such a long career when someone's played so many different parts. How do you keep it fresh for yourself? How do you keep on kind of reinventing stuff? How do you keep it kind of like interesting going forward as an actor?
That's a great question. I mean, I did spend a few years doing live dinner theater, mystery theater. And the reason I bring that up is because what makes that fresh is that you connect with the audience live. If, for example, before I go on stage in the dinner theater atmosphere, I always look to see, okay, those people look like they're having fun. Oh, there's a stag party there. There's a graduation party here. Oh, and there's a guy at the back who looks like he's a biker gang leader, and he doesn't look like he's happy to be here. So I focus on him, try to get him to smile. So that's how I keep it fresh. When it comes to television, film, whatever I'm going through in my life, I try to connect to the text in that way, bring whatever I can to the text, and then eventually find that it comes off the page. I guess it's a cliched thing to say, but it's every role should be a challenge. Even if it's the same, you try to find, okay, this character needs a little humor, I got to add humor. This character needs to be a little more intimidating, I got to add that. You just try to bring as much of yourself as possible so that they look at it and go, he may or may not be right for that role, but that was a great audition. And, you know, consequently, I do audition for the same production companies more often than others, because there is a simpatico, a repartee going on because of who you are and the work you bring. You can't change who you are. That's the illusion of acting, is really you're not changing. You're just being you with different words and a different costume.
Well, before I let you go, just to put a button on this interview, obviously it's coming up to 30 years since Due South ended, let alone began, and wow. So kind of around that period to when your journey began in Due South, looking back at it, how would you sum up your kind of how you feel about Due South and that experience, and maybe a little word for all the fans watching tonight and when this comes out later?
There is a word that it's a cliche. It's been said many times. And as I was told by a fellow actor many years ago, he said, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. So enjoy it while it's here. Embrace it. So when I take on roles now, I really try to savor everything, even driving to the set, eating the lunch, coming home, savor it all, because it could be gone like that.
Tom, thank you so much for being so giving of your time, not only tonight, but you're always there and present for the fans. And I know it means a lot to all of us. So just thank you so much, sir.
You're welcome. You guys mean a lot to me, too. I appreciate it.
So for this being week, I've been Detective Squee, somewhere about, she's been a bit camera shy tonight, has been Willow over there. And again, a shout out to Mounty Michelle, who will be back with us for another fun episode soon. And thank you so much. Once again, give it up in your individual homes for my guest this week, Tom Melissus.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Kindly. And until next week, next time, because let's face it, I can't keep to weekly on this schedule. But until next time, please keep your compasses pointed due south by southeast.